Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. In Canterbury, Connecticut, tucked away in the eastern side of the state and behind a white post and rail fence, there's a beautiful old house with a truly remarkable history. It's the Prudence Crandall Museum, and it's home to what was the nation's first private academy for young African-American women. Kaz Kozlowski has been the curator at the Prudence Crandall Museum for the past 35 years, and she retired earlier this year. Soon after she announced her retirement, I sat down with Kaz and asked her to tell us Prudence Crandall's story about how in 1832, Crandall, as a white Quaker-raised woman, decided to turn her school, once meant to educate the fine white female citizenry, into a school that championed young black girls from the Northeast's free black community. As Kaz Kozlowski is quick to say, the story doesn't really begin with Prudence Crandall. It begins with a young African-American woman with a thirst for knowledge, Sarah Harris.
If there was not a Sarah Harris, there would be no Prudence Crandall and there would be no Prudence Crandall Museum. She's the linchpin in the entire story because in the fall of 1832, Sarah Harris is looking to get a further education for herself, comes to Crandall that fall and requests, as we have in her own words, to get a little more learning.
You know, you must have wished this so many times over your more than 30 years at the museum to have been a fly on the wall in the room.
In many, many instances, to be able to really hear the conversation that would have gone between those two women. You had Crandall, who was an extremely, she was educated, she was strong, came from a family that was very steely in their nature. And then to have Sarah Harris, who, again, to the credit of her family, her parents, they raised a young woman that had the fortitude and the self-respect and also, the courage herself to make that request. But to hear that conversation between the two of them. I mean, in fact, we do know that when Sarah made the request of Crandall, she basically added a disclaimer. She said to Crandall, "I would like to get a little more learning, if at least to educate other young black students. But if my request will bring you any harm, I will withdraw it." So she realizes what that request is asking and gives her that. If Crandall felt that she wasn't able to answer yes, then she's giving her a way to be able to say no. But we do know that Crandall never saw no as the answer to give.
Because here's the thing, right? I mean, those two women together were basically imagining something that didn't really exist at all at the time, right? An integrated school. They were imagining a world that didn't yet exist.
Right. And Meghna, do keep in mind that schools, most of them here in Connecticut, would have been integrated. One-room schoolhouse, those public schools would have had white and black children being educated in the same classroom. What Crandall and Sarah are envisioning is a higher level of education that was never seen before. It was the first private academy, the first in the nation, to have provided education to young black women.
I see. So Prudence said yes.
She did. And she said yes, but she hesitates for just a bit, only to the effect that she begins looking at if and when the pushback would happen, what she would do in response to that.
And the pushback did happen.
What
happened?
Initially, when word gets out that Crandall has allowed Sarah Harris into the academy as a paid student, many of the white families come to her, begin threatening that if she doesn't withdraw Sarah Harris from the academy, they would begin withdrawing their own children. They assume that with the threat that she would back down, but she doesn't. She looks at that as, well, perhaps if I'm losing the support of the white community, what can I do to increase support? And what would the option be? And she begins to realize, well, if there is one Sarah Harris, if there's one Harris family that can afford the tuition to send their daughter here, perhaps there were other upper middle class African-American families that might have daughters who they would also be interested to send. And again, as fate would have it, Sarah Harris had begun leaving copies of the Liberator newspaper at the academy. And they realized that Crandall had been reading these papers. So with that knowledge, when Crandall realizes that she's losing the support of the white community, she sends a letter up to Boston to William Lloyd Garrison, the publisher of the Liberator paper, sends a letter of introduction and makes arrangements that she would meet with him in January of 1833. And when she arrives there, she already goes there with this seed of an idea that perhaps he would be able to give her letters of introduction to other families who might be interested in sending their daughters to her school.
Just to not to put too fine a point on it, or actually, you know, let me take that back. I will put a finer point on it. I mean, I've read that there were attacks on the school. Is that right?
There were. Over the coming months, the anger, the animosity, the pushback increased from... she formally reopened the academy on April 1st, 1833, with advertisements that stated that it was making a shift and becoming an academy solely for the purpose of educating little misses, young ladies and little misses of color. When that announcement is made about a month later in May of 1833, the legislature in Hartford, they pass what was called the Black Law, which makes it illegal for Crandall to operate the academy. But she continues. She continues even after she's arrested. She spends one night in Brooklyn, Connecticut's jail. That would have been the county seat at the time. It escalates from the legal actions to the academy would have been, you know, pelted with filth. The girls were threatened. Over the 17 months that the academy actually functioned and remained open, the anger continued to increase to, in January of 1834, there's an attempt to set the building on fire. And then it's on September 9th, 1834, the final, her determination that she can't keep the academy open anymore is when a mob attacks the building. It was a feat to have it open. 17 minutes would have been something, but to be able to do that for 17 months was just phenomenal.
Yeah. About the Black Law, are you saying that the state of Connecticut went out of its way, essentially, to pass a law putting major obstacles in the path of anyone who wanted to teach African-American students because of Prudence Crandall's school?
That's in a nutshell, yes. They formulated the law in direct response to what she was doing. It did not affect public schools, so it did not impact Black children going to Connecticut's one-room schoolhouses, the district schools, but they made it illegal for anyone to establish a private academy for African-American students in Connecticut without getting the town's prior approval, which she had not done. And even if she had made the request, the response would have been no.
There's so much to talk with you about, Kaz. I don't even know where to go. Because do I understand correctly that the person who wrote the Black Law in 1833, 5 years later, fought for its repeal?
Yes. A man by the name of Senator Philip Pearl was a staunch colonizationist, very pro-slavery when he assisted in passing the Black Law in 1833. Some 5 years later, when the law was repealed, by that point, he had had this change of heart and basically said that he would shed tears of blood for his involvement in what he had done those years previous. He was so ashamed of himself, and he became a staunch abolitionist in his later years.
Gosh, wow.
Yeah, he saw the error of his ways and did try to make amends for it.
What happened? What ended up happening to Prudence Crandall?
So the students in their own right went on to become teachers, activists. They were involved in abolition, Underground Railroad. What was instilled in them, what they shared during those 17 months, they took with them. And Crandall, on her part, she also continued to be a teacher. So even after the academy was forced to close in September of 1834, but wherever she found herself, she was providing an education.
I'm seeing here that at least at one point in time, she was in Kansas teaching Native American students.
She was. She taught in both. She lived in Illinois for a period of time and then spent her later years in a small community in southeastern Kansas, Elk Falls, Kansas. We know that she taught in both the district schools and also in her home. And we know she taught adults, children, Native Americans, white, African Americans, truly whoever in that community needed an education, she was there for them.
And it seems as if there are so many people who are connected to this story in ways that I had never heard of before I started looking into this. And in anticipation of talking to you, Mark Twain has a connection to Prudence Crandall?
He did. He actually offered to buy the house back the building that had housed her academy in the 1830s. He was willing to buy that for her if she was willing to move back to Connecticut. And obviously, it goes without saying how flattered she was. She knew of him, you know, his reputation. They corresponded. And as flattered as she was by the offer, but her response to him was something that the air was much sweeter in Kansas than it had ever been in Connecticut. But would he be so kind as to send a photograph of himself and copies of some of his books, which she would then share with her neighbors?
Now, Kaz, the last couple of questions I have for you are about, you know, how much progress we have or haven't made since the 1830s. Because someone drove by the school while you were during your time there and yelled a racial epithet. Is that right?
I think the story that you're referring to happened probably 15, 20 years ago, where it was an August evening, probably 1 or 2 in the morning. Again, Canterbury is a quiet community, you know, no sound other than the crickets and dogs barking. And in the midst of all of this, a car came, you know, kind of, zooming down one of the side roads, and someone yelled something out of the car that, you know, all of a sudden you realize what it must have felt like, or not, at least it was close to imagining what it would have felt like for those young women to hear people yelling insults at them and making threats at them. You know, I'm not going to repeat what they said because I wouldn't dignify it, but it really sent chills.
So here we are in 2018. Have we achieved the world that Prudence and Sarah envisioned when Sarah came to her and said, "I want to learn," and Prudence said, "Come to my school"? I mean, have we achieved that world?
I think, Magna, as difficult this is a tough one.
Why is it a tough one?
Because I never would have imagined that we would be living through a period of time that hate and racial bias and, splitting communities rather than pulling together would be used as a political means. Again, that's my personal opinion, but I think I don't think Prudence and Sarah could have envisioned the political environment that we're in the middle of right now, but I think they would have assured us that the majority of individuals are better than that. But on the other side of that coin, this past year working at the Crandall Museum has brought in visitors who are looking to talk about issues, who are looking for a place to explore their history. And I think part of that is to be reminded that we're better than that, and that we owe those people who did what they did, you know, so many years ago to fight for a better world, that we owe them to fight that same fight.
Mm. I mean, doesn't the very existence of Prudence Crandall and Sarah Harris and their story, and that's told by the museum today, doesn't that also remind us that if we can imagine a better future, we can take steps to achieving it? Because they were living in a time where, you know, I mean, I think it's pretty fair to say the divisions were even deeper. People were enslaved, you know, people were denied their civil rights by law, and yet they dared to think that things could be different.
I think that's perfect. I couldn't have said it better, Magna. I think that is the, to be able to look at it as difficult as it is. And again, I think that's why it's so important to know our history, because what we see today, people endured so much worse than that and were able to achieve so much better.
Kaz, you've been at the museum for 35 years. What are you going to do next?
Yeah, well, I look forward to, and I think, as I've said to everybody who's asked me that, I think Crandall and Sarah's story isn't something that you can walk away from. So what I look forward to is there's still a lot of research work that needs to be done. And I think personally, I'd like to be able to do justice to the stories of the young African-American women who attended the academy. So that's what I'm hoping. I think I'd like to take a little bit, let the dust settle. But I think eventually Prudence and Sarah call us all back. So there's no walking away from that.
Well, Kaz Kozlowski served as curator of the Prudence Crandall Museum for 35 years. She's just recently retired. It's been such a pleasure to speak with you, and thank you for your work. Thank you so very much.
Oh, thank you for the opportunity, Magda. And again, it's an amazing story. I'm glad that I could share it with you.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.